John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, August 31st, 2011. More Israeli settlers' vandalism in the West Bank, and Israel reveals the name of a man who attacked Israeli settlers in Tel Aviv. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli settlers uprooted olive trees in Deristia village near Safid in the western part of the West Bank Wednesday morning. Nazim Salman, head of the village council, said that settlers uprooted 32 trees that belonged to Abdel Karim Mansour. Salman added that the settlers came from the nearby Yakir settlement, noting that this is not the first time the area was subject to similar attacks due to the high number of Israeli illegal settlements in the region. The Israeli military revealed the name of a Palestinian who wounded 8 Israelis in Tel Aviv on Sunday night. The Israeli newspaper Idaot Ahronot said in its online edition that the man was identified as Mohammed Safan, 20, from the West Bank city of Nablus. Safan allegedly hit some Israelis with a stolen taxi and stabbed others before the Israeli police managed to subdue him and take him into custody. Two of the wounded are in serious condition. The sources did not reveal further information about the intention behind the attack, but said that Safan claimed responsibility for this attack. Reuven Rivlin, head of the Israeli Knesset, said on Wednesday that all the land of Israel belongs to the Jewish people, and peace will never prevail until the Palestinians accept to live together with the Jews on this land. Rivlin's statement came during his visit to the illegal settlement of Itamar near Nablus. Rivlin added that settlements are part of Zionism. Rivlin is known to be a far-right-wing member of Knesset from the ruling Likud party. He rejects the two-state solution and believes that the West Bank and Gaza Strip must be annexed to Israel. On the other hand, a Republican congresswoman introduced a bill along with 57 co-sponsors asking Congress to block U.S. funds for any United Nations entity that supports giving Palestine an elevated status at the UN. Israeli media sources reported that Representative Liana Ross Lehtinen is also seeking to ban U.S. contributions to the U.N. Human Rights Council and an anti-racism conference seen as a platform for anti-Israel rhetoric. Ross Lehtinen is known of her anti-UN positions. She wrote in her letter to her colleagues that a Palestinian self-declared state, quote, would short-circuit the negotiating process and would severely undermine opportunities for peace between Israel and Palestinians, end quote. That was some of the news from Palestine today. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imunc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, George Rishmael.
Afghanistan today. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unspecified nationality from a roadside bombing attack in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, yesterday, the British military is reporting the death of a British Marine from an IED blast in the Sukhmanda area of the Nari Sharaf district, Helmand Province, Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Saturday, NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unspecified nationality from an IED attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Sunday. NATO is reporting the death of three soldiers of unspecified nationality from IED attacks in undisclosed locations in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, midnight Thursday. Six Afghan civilians from the same family were killed by a NATO airstrike in Logar Province. Logar Provincial Police Chief Ghulam Sak Roj Lawani said the operation targeted a Taliban commander with a bounty on his head known as Quarry Hijran and had also killed civilians. Quote, four Taliban militants were killed along with three Afghan army and six members of a family during the incident, he said. Gee, how accurate NATO bombers are! Pakistan, Sunday. 17 rockets were fired into Angkor Ada, Pakistan, from Afghanistan. They landed in an uninhabited area of Angkor Ada, due to which no loss of life or injury was reported. Baghdad, Iraq, Sunday. A suicide bomber blew himself up inside the Umm al-Qura Mosque, Baghdad's largest Sunni mosque, Sunday night, killing 29 people during prayers. Major General Qasem al-Musawi, a spokesman for Baghdad's Military Operations Command, confirmed the bombing and the death toll. So much for the success of the occupation in controlling sectarian violence. Baghdad, Iraq, yesterday. Cops are being hunted in the streets. Three policemen on a foot patrol were killed by armed men in a speeding car in eastern Baghdad. In a second attack, two Iraqi federal cops were killed and one wounded when they were attacked by an unknown group with weapons equipped with silencers who stormed into a federal police checkpoint east of Baghdad. Diyala Province, Iraq, yesterday. A bomb exploded in the main street of Aqaba City, targeting a police patrol. Five cops were wounded. Mosul, Iraq, yesterday. A car bomb killed an Iraqi soldier and wounded nine people, including a traffic policeman, when it went off in the northern outskirts of Mosul. Mosul, Iraq, yesterday. A second car bomb exploded near a police center in northwest Mosul with no casualties. Security sources report only a partial detonation. Basra, Iraq, Friday. Unknown gunmen launched three missiles from inside Iraqi territories towards Kuwaiti Bubiyan Island. The missiles landed in Gulf waters, the source reported. Kuwait, on the other hand, did not report any missile attack from Iraq. On Saturday, the head of the Security Commission in Basra said that the rockets launched were not directed against a Kuwaiti Mubarak terminal, but poke a prison, charging that it was an attempt to destroy the Iraqi economy. That's a strange thing to do by destroying a prison. Baghdad, Iraq. Today, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki promised that U.S. forces will pull back from Iraq according to the program set at the end of the current year. So much for all that crap about extending the U.S. occupation. Was this just another false promise? Mr. Barack Obama, now is the time to pull the plug on war, bring all the troops home today from Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq.
In the decades since the 9/11 terror attack, the New York Police Department has conducted unprecedented intelligence operations in Muslim communities, including assigning covert agents to area mosques. An investigation by the Associated Press conducted over 40 interviews with retired and current New York Police Department and federal officials detailing operations which appear to violate civil liberties protections. The NYPD often used so-called rakers in ethnic communities who observe daily life in bars, nightclubs, and bookstores to seek out useful intelligence on potential terrorists. The NYPD also used what they called Muslim crawlers to monitor services in mosques, even though there was no evidence of any wrongdoing. The aggressive intelligence sweeps occurred after the NYPD hired David Cohen, a retired CIA agent, to run its intelligence unit in early 2002. Among his most controversial operations was to perform background checks on every Pakistani cab driver working in New York City. In response to the AP investigation, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, a civil rights group, called on the U.S. Justice Department to investigate possible wrongdoing. Chris Dunn of the New York Civil Liberties Union observed that the NYPD intelligence unit has gotten extremely aggressive and sophisticated, but is operating completely on its own. There is no oversight.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Today, 111 people were arrested in front of the White House in the 12th day of tar sands protests and civil disobedience. There is unrest in the forest. Protesters are demanding that the State Department, which President Obama can unilaterally control, refuse the permits for the Keystone XL tar sands oil pipeline to cross the border from Canada to the U.S. This pipeline would carry oil from the filthy Alberta tar sands oil mining project U.S. refineries in Texas. This surface mined oil is about 20% more carbon, climate change, and hurricane intensive than regular oil. This oil is strip mined, destroying the land. The deep oil, which is extracted in place, is even worse. It has to be liquefied with hot steam to bring it to the surface, or else partially burned in place with pumped in oxygen. These methods can, at worst, produce oil five times as carbon intensive as normal, far worse than the worst of the coal industry. Those who care about what's left of our planet have had enough, and they have been carrying out acts of civil disobedience for the past 12 days in front of the White House, except that is, when Hurricane Irene was in town, making her own statement about climate change. How else do you get ocean water warm enough to make a hurricane keep all the way to Vermont?
Now there's no more roads of oppression, or the cast and over Here is Amy Goodman's recent Democracy Now! Interview with Bill McKibbins concerning the pipeline protests in front of the White House, the Keystone XL pipeline, the recent hurricane, and global climate change. As of today, Bill McKibbins has even been published in Newsweek. The protests against the Keystone XL pipeline are beginning to bite, and people are starting to pay attention. Without further ado, here's Amy Goodman interviewing Bill McKibbin.
Hey, Amy, it was very good to hear Governor Shumlin, and of course, it's unbelievably hard not to be home. My town is taking a beating. The town next door, East Middlebury, was apparently evacuated last night. All the roads connecting up to my town are cut off. It's killing me not to be there, and I'd be there in a flash, except that I think the work we're doing here in Washington right now is key towards trying to rein this kind of thing in the future.
We did not hear those words, global warming. I watched a lot of the media coverage this weekend. What about this? I mean, to say the least, there was time and the endless coverage.
Well, here's what's, I mean, first of all, here's what's going on. I mean, I wrote the first book about climate change 22 years ago this year. And I should begin by saying there's very little satisfaction in saying I told you so. We knew then enough to predict exactly what was going to happen. And climatologists 22 years ago were saying this is what to look forward to. The basic physical property here is that warm air holds more water vapor than cold. You can get stronger storms. The atmosphere is about 4% wetter than it was 40 years ago. That's an enormous change in a basic physical parameter. It loads the dice for both drought, as you're getting increased evaporation, and deluge and downpour and flood, and that's what we're seeing all over the planet. You remember the pictures from Pakistan this time last summer with a quarter of the country underwater. You remember the pictures from Queensland in Australia. You remember the pictures earlier this year in the Missouri and Mississippi River basins, which saw more water go down them than ever before. As Governor Shumlin said, the Northeast was hard hit earlier this year. We had absolutely record flood levels at Lake Champlain, where there are records dating back more than 250 years. Now we're seeing, as this water drops across the Northeast, rivers and streams at levels that we have literally never seen them before. That's what it means when a 250-year-old covered bridge goes washing down the Queechee River. It's on the one hand, entirely predictable, and on the other hand, the greatest sort of series of wake-up calls that we could possibly be getting. So far this year, it's only August, so far this year, the U.S. has suffered more billion-dollar weather-related disasters than any year in history. Last year was the warmest year in the planet's history. Arctic ice is at record low levels, on and on and on. Which is why, you know, I mean, we're going to have to do two things. One, as Governor Shumlin says, is figure out how we protect places against trouble that we can no longer completely prevent. We've already raised the temperature of the planet a degree. That's not going away. The scientists tell us there's another degree in the pipeline that's coming at us from a carbon we've already emitted. So that's job one. Job two, equally important, is stop pouring more into the atmosphere. And that's why I think that message is getting through. I was worried that Hurricane Irene would slow down these protests that have been building in Washington, that last week were the biggest civil disobedience protests in at least in a generation in the environmental movement. I need not have worried. I was at the church last night where people were preparing for this morning's arrests, by far the biggest crowd yet, over 100 people who'll be arrested, along with Jim Hansen, the NASA scientist, who said if we start burning these unconventional fuel sources in a big way, then it's essentially game over for the climate. Game over. I mean, right now, game on.
Explain. In the last few weeks, we've experienced earthquakes, which many scientists say are not related to climate change, and I'd like to get your view on that. And then we move right to this unprecedented hurricanes. And again, for people to understand how hurricanes work and why, for example, Vermont is seeing floods reminiscent of 1927. A number of bridges.
Floods worse than 1927, yeah.
And so much was wiped out at that time that a lot of time you can trace 80 years to what we saw in Vermont in 1938 and 1927, the great hurricane, these two great disasters.
The, we're in unprecedented, off the charts territory. It's not that there haven't been disasters before. There've always been disasters. Nature is relatively random in that sense. But now we're seeing two things. One, disasters that go beyond the bounds of what we've ever seen before. Because there's more water in the atmosphere, it's possible to have bigger floods, record snowfalls when it's cold, record rainstorms. And we're seeing more of them in conjunction. I mean, think about what's been going on just on this continent this year. We're about 1.5% of the surface area of the globe in the continental U.S. And we've had not only this extraordinary flooding, but on the same day that Hurricane Irene was coming down, Houston set its all-time temperature record, 109 degrees. We're in the middle of the worst drought ever recorded in Texas. And, you know, Governor Perry's prayers for rain have so far been unanswered, maybe because he's done so little to ameliorate the flow of carbon into the atmosphere. We're in a new situation. It doesn't mean that everything that happens is caused by global warming. Hurricanes aren't caused by global warming. They're caused by tropical waves drifting off the coast of Africa and encountering the Earth's spin, you know, that can begin to set them into rotation. But they are made more powerful. As this hurricane rode up the coast, one of the reasons it was able to pick up so much water that it's now dumping on Vermont and Quebec is that sea surface temperatures were at an all-time record high off New York and New Jersey. Never, the last 2 years have seen the highest temperatures ever recorded in those waters. When you amp up a system, and so far we've added about 0.75 watts per square meter of the Earth's surface extra solar energy to the planet by burning coal and gas and oil. When you do that, you can expect more dynamic, more amped up, more violent weather. And that's exactly what we're seeing. Earthquakes, with rare exceptions, are not climate related. There is reason to think that in certain localized places, earthquakes are now resulting from some of this kind of fracking attempts to get oil and gas out of the ground through unconventional means. And in Greenland, there's increased seismicity as that huge sheet of ice begins to melt and unweight the land beneath it. But for the most part, volcanic and tectonic forces are still beyond the reach of human beings. Everything else bears our thumbprint now. And the only way to deal with that is to quickly get off coal and gas and oil. We're not at the moment in our Congress, you know, prepared to do that. That's why it's good news that at the very least, President Obama can keep us from getting in any deeper without even asking Congress. He can veto this Keystone Pipeline thing and prevent us from taking the next step into the brave new world of unconventional energy.
Bill McKibben, finally, the State Department ruling, why so many are being arrested in Washington, D.C., the XL pipeline.
Yeah. This pipeline goes to the second largest pool of carbon on the planet, the tar sands of Alberta. The State Department, which was responsible for doing an environmental impact statement, released its statement last Friday. It was completely expected. It has hundreds of pages of detailed accounting of exactly how many leaks per kilometer of pipeline are acceptable and on and on and on. What it doesn't talk about at all, does not even mention, are the carbon implications of opening up a Saudi-sized pool of oil. That oil has to stay in the ground. It's as important that it stay in the ground as it is that Brazil guard its rainforest. That's why Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people have been arrested here. This protest at tarsandsaction.org has taken off in ways that we couldn't have expected when we started a week ago. It's turned into something very, very large. All the environmental groups said last week that this was now the premier challenge on the environment for President Obama between now and the election. And they said, we expect nothing less than his veto, which he can do without even asking Congress. There's never been a purer test of whether or not we're prepared to stand up to climate change or not. I'm going back down to the White House this morning. There'll be more than 100 people arrested, on and on and on for the next few days, right through September 3rd. We hope that people will join us at tarsandsaction.org. This is sort of unexpectedly spiked into the biggest thing of its kind in a very long time. And that should be very good news. Part of the way that we react to traumas like Irene is to figure out how to prevent them from happening. I'm eating away at me not to be in Vermont, and I you know, can't tell you how worried I am for my friends and family up there. But the way that I'm going to show it today is being back in front of the White House and doing what we can to head this kind of thing off.
We want to thank you very much for being with us. Bill McKibben in Washington, D.C. right now, part of the mass protests around the XL Keystone pipeline.
Shale gas development has been touted as the biggest breakthrough in U.S. fossil fuel production in decades, allowing the natural gas industry to drill in areas that were previously inaccessible and proclaiming in media ads that the process, known as hydraulic fracturing or fracking, is the clean, safe, domestic power of the future. But fracking, in which millions of gallons of water, a secret mix of toxic chemicals and sand, are injected into wells to break apart shale and release trapped gas, has been found to pollute groundwater. One of the biggest areas being developed is the Marcellus Shale, a formation that covers parts of New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, and Virginia. Another shale formation covers the northern tip of New Jersey, whose legislature recently voted overwhelmingly to ban shale gas drilling. But New Jersey's Republican Governor Chris Christie announced on August 24th that instead of signing the ban bill, he was declaring a one-year moratorium so the process could be further evaluated. Meanwhile, a moratorium in New York on what many consider the most disruptive form of shale gas development is about to end, as the state's Department of Environmental Conservation is releasing a revised environmental impact study on the issue at the end of August. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Emily Wirth, Water Program Director at the Washington, D.C.-based group Food and Water Watch, which is pushing for a national ban on hydraulic fracturing to extract natural gas. She discusses the legislative and grassroots citizen efforts to stop or slow down fracking and points to the need for the nation to start developing renewable energy alternatives.
The New Jersey state legislature overwhelmingly voted for a ban on hydraulic fracturing in New Jersey earlier this year, and we have been waiting to see what Governor Christie would do on this. And instead of doing what was clearly in the best interest of the residents of New Jersey and what the state legislature wanted, he passed a conditional veto that would only establish a one-year moratorium on fracking, saying that had to do with waiting for further study to see what the effects were. That timeline is not in line with the EPA study, which is the most documented study that's looking into the effects of hydraulic fracturing on drinking water primarily. They will be doing some examination of other effects as well. But that study is not due to have any preliminary findings until the end of next year, which a lot of times these agency studies run over schedule, and then it's not due to be complete until 2014. So we have serious concerns, and at this point we're hoping that the state legislature, who had the votes needed to override the veto, will in fact put this to vote and vote to override Governor Christie's veto.
The vote was almost unanimous in the Senate, and I'm wondering if that was because even if shale drilling were allowed, there's very little shale in the state that holds gas that could be drilled for.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is some, and I think it sends an important message to the elected officials of neighboring states, Pennsylvania and New York, for them to take this action. I mean, you know, the waterways cross state lines, and we know there's been a hotly debated decision being made by the Delaware River Basin Commission about this. And that is subject to come up for a vote any time now. It could be as soon as the September 21st meeting. But, you know, the Delaware River provides drinking water for 3 million residents of New Jersey. So I think this was an effort made by the state legislature to weigh in on some of the larger regional decisions being made about this practice.
There was also a moratorium declared in New York State in 2010. Can you give us a little background?
What the New York State legislature voted for was a moratorium on both types of hydraulic fracturing, so vertical and horizontal. This gets into the slightly more technical side of this issue. There were lots of concerns because the vertical drilling is already taking place in New York State, in western New York in particular. And so what Patterson did was also a veto. He vetoed the state legislature's moratorium and made it only on the horizontal drilling, which is the kind of more invasive form, although there's problems with all of them, really.
So the moratorium was to stay in place until the revised environmental impact statement is released, and that's slated for August 31st, and then the public comment period begins.
That essentially ends the moratorium in New York, although permits won't be issued until they go through an official public comment period and actually then take the time to insert the public comment into a final draft.
So, Emily Wirth, things seem to be moving fast toward opening New York State to drilling. And I know the Department of Environmental Conservation's initial environmental impact statement in July said it could be allowed on most private property, but not in public parks or watersheds. It seems like a ban is pretty much out of the question.
I think that the next few months are critical, but we've seen movement. We've seen elected officials in New York who are not naturally, you know, prone to be strong on this issue come out really strongly. Republican Greg Ball comes to mind from the Hudson Valley area, and he's recently just was touring through counties like Bradford County and Susquehanna County in Pennsylvania where the intensive drilling has taken place and has come back with a really strong statement saying he doesn't want to see this happen in New York. And so, you know, I think the next few months will be very important for the movement, but we're hoping that that kind of gives people the opportunity to take a strong stance on this issue, including the state legislature in New York.
You know, it's interesting that this is happening now at the same time that people are in D.C. trying to stop the importation from Canada of incredibly polluting tar sands for fuel. Maybe it would be better to develop domestic natural gas and forget about the tar sands.
I think there's a lot of other opportunities in renewables and more sustainable, less dangerous and less polluting forms of energy, and that there's got to be more investment in research and kind of the startup of those. And I just also think, you know, that the oil and gas industry is tremendously powerful. And, you know, at Food and Water Watch, we think the kind of visionary route is to move away from the mature fossil fuel industries. Particularly, we shouldn't be subsidizing and granting exemptions to a profitable, mature industry. But instead, we should be investing in the technologies needed to really fully develop the sustainable and safe renewable sources of energy.
That was Emily Wirth of Food and Water Watch. Learn more about the efforts to stop natural gas hydraulic fracturing on our website at btlonline.org.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com.
August 26th. During a two-week mobilization to stop the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline at the White House, animal rights protesters showed up at the offices of the American Petroleum Institute, delivering a letter demanding that they stop testing unleaded gasoline on animals at Huntington Life Sciences.
So what happened when you tried to deliver a letter to the American Petroleum Institute demanding that they stop testing gasoline on animals with Huntington Life Sciences?
They won't let you go and meet directly with Gerard unless you have an appointment. So they told me I had to take the letter to the mailroom where it would be screened and then they would take it to him. So he turned a key for me to get up to the 9th floor where I went by myself, and I found the mailroom and they said they would get the letter to Gerard. So I dropped it off with them.
Had the letter been refused outright instead of redirected to the mailroom, the American Petroleum Institute here at 1220 I Street would have gotten a full-on Huntington Life Sciences protest with multiple bullhorns and the usual graphic signs. As it stands, they're going to be given a little time to respond to the letter, set up a meeting to discuss ceasing and desisting, sending any business to Huntington Life Sciences, putting an end to testing gasoline on rats when we already know that gasoline is toxic and kills.
AM on the 27th of August, as Hurricane Irene bore down on Washington, D.C., animal rights activists showed up outside the home of Brian Maloney, Associate Director of Global Public Policy and Issues Management at AstraZeneca. AstraZeneca is a customer of puppy-killing Huntington Life Sciences, which tortures 500 animals to death every single day. Didn't take long for a peaceful and legal animal rights protest to lead to a furious confrontation with one of Brian Maloney's neighbors who lived in the same high-rise.
Here's your issue. If you have an issue, take it up with Brian.
You heard that. Take it up with Brian. You got a puppy killer for a neighbor.
Chocolate City, this is movement music.
Have you heard the news?
Walmart's coming.
Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something?
Something.
Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping, cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping.
Something.
See, you can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave labors. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market, hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to unionize, soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than the male equivalent. On these issues and more, we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunity stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step 2, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step 3, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart. It's not a good fit for Chocolate City. Let me holla black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember DC doesn't work with the right wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister. Strom Thurmond, similar. Confederate state loving George Bush ministers. Oversee your plantation mentality. Results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs, and now they wanna come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts, Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
Keep DC Walmart free is an emerging activist group of DC residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in DC by 2012. Walmarts in DC will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.
After a 2-week strike, 45,000 Verizon workers from Virginia to New England, including landline telephone technicians and consumer representatives, went back to work without a new contract. Larry Cohen, president of the Communication Workers of America, says the strike ended because Verizon withdrew major concession demands and agreed to extend the current contract until a new labor agreement is reached. Verizon claims it needs to reduce employee benefit plans because of increasing competition and reduced profitability. But with a surging wireless division, Verizon has made over $22 billion in profits since 2007. The top 5 executives at the telecom giant made over $258 million in compensation over the last 4 years, and the company secured $1.3 billion in tax rebates from Uncle Sam in 2010. Volatile issues like health care and job security remain on the negotiating table. Union members expressed concern that Verizon could impose 12-hour workdays, forcing union technicians to repair mistakes made by its non-union replacements during the walkout. Striking CWA and International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers had picketed outside Verizon wireless stores to dissuade customers from doing business with the telecom company.
Representatives of all 50 states are negotiating with the largest U.S. banks to settle charges of improper conduct on mortgage servicing and their involvement in producing hundreds of thousands of fraudulent robo-signed mortgage documents. But Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller, who is spearheading the investigation, has recently dismissed New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman from the 13-member executive committee guiding the negotiations, charging that Schneiderman had undermined the group's effort to reach a settlement. Schneiderman objects to a proposed deal with the banks that would prevent further investigations and prosecution of financial institutions' reckless bundling or securitizing risky mortgages as investments, which in part triggered the 2008 global economic meltdown. The banks, some Obama administration officials, the Justice Department, and HUD are reportedly pushing for a deal to be reached quickly. A spokesperson for Schneiderman says ongoing investigations by attorneys general cannot be shut down by efforts to settle quickly, and those responsible must be held accountable. The New Bottom Line campaign, a coalition of grassroots community, faith, and labor organizations, supports Schneiderman's stand and is demanding a strong settlement agreement with principal reductions for those at risk of foreclosure, criminal penalties for bankers who committed mortgage fraud, restitution for families who lost their homes due to fraud, and strict enforcement of the settlement terms on the banks. Your reporter spoke with Liz Ryan Murray, policy director with National People's Action, a member organization of the New Bottom Line campaign. She discusses Schneiderman's dismissal and protest actions being planned to hold big banks accountable.
The attorneys general really started this investigation out of the robo-signing scandal that hit last year. And robo-signing is where banks, you know, in their rush to make all of these mortgages and to make all these subprime and mortgages that brought down our economy, were not careful about what they did with their paperwork. They transferred titles, they did all these things, and nobody really necessarily knew where the paperwork was. Come time, they want to start throwing people out of their houses, and they can't prove they own them. So instead of doing the due diligence and figuring out what's going on and trying to save people's homes, they've set up warehouses of people signing their names over and over again, that they were notaries or vice presidents of banks, just over and over again, blatant forgery and fraud to throw people out of their homes. When that hit, all attorneys general, all 50 of them, came together to start investigating that and some of the other fraud that was going on in foreclosure practices, people not getting a fair shake to really save their homes, people having to submit paperwork 10, 15, 20 times and then still getting thrown out of their homes. So they really started to look at that and try to come up with a solution to start to make people whole and to start cleaning up the Banks Act, hold them accountable for what they've been doing, and make them stop doing it. What happened is the banks now are being investigated for this. They want to reach a settlement that lets them off scot-free for everything, from soup to nuts. They steered people into mortgages when they could have afforded cheaper mortgages. They steered them into more expensive ones, especially blacks and Latinos. So the banks, they want to sign on the dotted line, get a really quick settlement, get off easy, and then be held not culpable for any of that. They want it all over with. And Eric Schneiderman is saying, hold on, we haven't done an investigation into any of these things. We can't let them off the hook for all the securitization fraud, the chain of title fraud, the origination fraud, when we haven't looked at it. He's saying whatever solution you come up with, other attorneys general, you can't close the door on me and some of the other states actually going after and getting some relief for homeowners and investors on that end.
Liz, what's the role of the Obama administration been in terms of aggressively going after the banks or just working out some sweetheart deal with the big banks? And as President Obama's fond of saying, looking forward and not looking backward, which has a lot of people angry, of course, because they want accountability.
Absolutely. I mean, we can't paper over this. It's hard to say. At the moment, again, there's some of the signs that we're seeing are not incredibly encouraging. The Department of Justice is also a part of this investigation with the 50 attorneys general. They're going to be signing off on this as well. What we're hearing is that they are also pushing for speed. And speed is great if it's going to really help people. Because as I said, there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of folks losing their homes. And if we can help them, that's great. But we can't let speed be the enemy of doing something with quality. So we're hearing that they're pushing for quickness. And we just can't have quickness if it means no real help.
If you were to put in a nutshell what your group's demands are here in terms of the attorney generals that are negotiating with the big banks and the Obama administration and their Justice Department, what's the most important demand you guys have?
I think principal reduction, because that's the real solution. Until people get an opportunity to actually build some wealth again, and that goes in hand with an opportunity to really modify their mortgage to an affordable place where they can stay in their homes. If we can get the mortgage market and do this kind of massive reset, we're going to be on so much stronger footing economically and in the housing market and the jobs market. I would say another biggie is the release of claims issue that we've talked about at length, that we have to make sure that this is narrow, that we're just giving release here on what's been investigated and not the whole host of the problem. And I would add one more that's also very important. This has been going on for several years, and there are thousands, millions, honestly, of families who have lost their homes, and probably, oh, definitely, we've seen the paperwork, many of them illegally. There needs to be restitution for those folks. If it's possible for them to get their house back, they need to get their house back. If it's not, then they need to be compensated at a degree that's measured with the harm. We can't just forget those people. So we need to take care of the people who are struggling now. Take care of the people who have already been tossed out due to this criminal fraudulent system, just addressing the part of the problem that has been investigated.
What's happening in terms of street action to demand the government, Congress, our representatives in Washington, do something to hold these banks accountable?
Absolutely. I mean, it's key to what we do, and it's in our blood. We're really trying to give a voice. People are incredibly frustrated, and people are angry about what the banks have gotten away with and with the fact that the poorest in our country and those who can least afford it are being asked to shoulder all the burden. So we're really bringing that message out to the streets. We started with, in August, doing some town hall work. Our group in Iowa are actually the ones who got Mitt Romney to admit that corporations, in his opinion, are people. Keeping that up to bring that message. And then starting in September and through October, we're going to be having rolling sustained actions around the country. In New York, they're going to really be focusing on the millionaire's tax. The fact that New York is sitting on $5 billion a year annually that they're not taking by letting the millionaire's tax expire at the end of the year. In Chicago, we're going to have a week or more of actions focused in part on the Mortgage Bankers Association, who are coming to town, getting on the street, tying these things of bank accountability and really addressing the revenue crisis. There'll be actions in Minnesota, on the West Coast, across the middle of the country, all through September and into October.
That was Liz Ryan Murray, Policy Director at National People's Action and member of the New Bottom Line campaign. Visit our Between the Lines website to learn more about groups demanding accountability from big banks involved in mortgage fraud.